Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Thousands of refugees and migrants in eastern and western Africa are dying while others face harrowing abuse in their attempts to reach the continent's Mediterranean coast in search of a better life, UN humanitarians said on Wednesday. Testimonies published by the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, and the Danish Refugee Council reveal random killings, torture, forced labour and beatings. Smugglers and traffickers were key abusers, but so too were state officials, to a surprising extent, said Vincent Cochetel, UNHCR Special Envoy for the Central Mediterranean.
In 47% of the case, the victims reported the perpetrators of violence are law enforcement authorities, whereas in the past we believed that it was mainly smugglers and traffickers. Yes, they are key perpetrators of violence, but the primary perpetrators of violence are people who are supposed to protect.
Data suggests that at least 1,750 people died leaving Western or Eastern African nations en route to countries including Libya, Egypt or Algeria in 2018 and 2019. This represents more than 70 deaths a month, making it one of the most deadly routes for refugees and migrants in the world, UNHCR said in a statement. Almost 3 in 10 people died attempting to cross the Sahara Desert, according to the UN agency. Other lethal hotspots included locations in southern Libya, such as Saba, Kufra and Katrun, in addition to the smuggling hub of Bani Walid, southeast of Tripoli, and several places along the West African section of the migrant route, including Bamako in Mali and Agadez in Niger. The COVID-19 crisis has cost global tourism $320 billion in the first 5 months of the year, with 300 million fewer visitors than normal. Announcing the findings on Tuesday, the UN World Tourism Organization, UNWTO, said that the setback is more than 3 times the losses seen during the global economic crisis of 2009. According to the UN agency's World Tourism Barometer, lockdowns imposed in response to the pandemic led to a 98% fall in international tourist numbers in May compared to 2019. While tourism is slowly returning to some destinations, traveller confidence has dropped to record lows. The agency also highlighted that travel restrictions and border shutdowns are still in place in most destinations and major outbound markets are at a standstill, such as the United States and China. Nonetheless, most members of an expert UNWTO panel said that they expected international tourism to recover by the second half of 2021, with others forecasting a rebound in the first part of next year. People have the right to demonstrate peacefully and governments should respect international law and let them do so, senior UN-appointed independent rights experts said on Wednesday. The legal advice is from the UN Human Rights Committee, whose 18 experts monitor how countries implement the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. The panel's general comment notes that protesters have the right to wear masks or hoods to cover their face and that governments should not collect personal data to harass or intimidate participants. The development comes at a time of worldwide protests in support of the Black Lives Matter movement and clarifies how peaceful assembly should be understood by the 173 countries which have ratified the covenant. Committee member Christoph Heinz said that it was a fundamental human right for people to gather to celebrate or to air grievances in public and in private spaces, outdoors, indoors and online. Everyone, including children, foreign nationals, women, migrant workers, asylum seekers and refugees, can exercise the right of peaceful assembly, he added. The committee's advice also notes that governments could not prohibit protests by making generalized references to public order or public safety or an unspecified risk of potential violence. In addition, governments cannot block internet networks or close down any website because of their roles in organizing or soliciting a peaceful assembly, according to the committee. It also stressed the right of journalists and human rights observers to monitor and document any assembly, including violent and unlawful ones. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, was formed 100 years ago. Just last week, its Oregon affiliate launched a lawsuit against Trump for sending in paramilitary forces into Portland, Oregon. We're joined today by constitutional litigator and scholar Stephen Rohde, who is on the board of the Southern California ACLU, to talk about the history of the ACLU and its current fights.
Attorney Nathalie Segovia joins us to talk about legal developments in the Dakota Access and Keystone XL pipelines. During the month of July, several courts ruled on the legality of proceeding with both pipelines, including the U.S. Supreme Court. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The American Civil Liberties Union was formed 100 years ago in 1920 in a climate of fear in our country, not unlike what exists today. Anarchists and socialists were scapegoated. They were rounded up, tried under the newly passed Espionage Act, and hundreds were deported or imprisoned, Eugene B. Debs being the most prominent. To mark a century of defense of the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights, Ellis Close has written an important history of the ACLU called Democracy, If We Can Keep It, the ACLU's 100-year fight for rights in America. The Los Angeles Review of Books recently featured an extensive appreciation of Close's book, written by constitutional attorney Stephen Rohde. Attorney Rohde has been on the board of the Southern California ACLU for over 25 years. He's taught constitutional law and has written a number of books on the subject. Stephen Rohde, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. It's a real pleasure always to be with you.
Well, I read your extensive review of the book about the history of the ACLU. It couldn't have been more timely, given the situation in our country today. And I wanted to ask you initially, what was the political situation like in the USA in 1920 when the ACLU was formed?
Well, in many ways, Michael, it had elements of what we're existing in today. But you can only imagine a small group of courageous civil libertarians, that word and name was only being developed in 1920, that were facing fascism, that were facing repression and the suppression of constitutional rights, of assembly, of protest, of organizing. It grew out of a group of women who earlier were protesting World War I, the draft, and conscription and militarism. So there's a very strong feminist origins to the founding of the ACLU, and we'll talk about that separately, perhaps. So this group met in New York. They came from different strains of the political left. They realized that it was necessary to resist the government. Up until that time, there had never been a private organization exclusively dedicated to defending the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. The Constitution and the Bill of Rights itself was not heavily litigated. The first Supreme Court cases in the Supreme Court on the First Amendment came in 1919. So this group saw the need to make real, to breathe life into the Bill of Rights, into the First Amendment. And they realized they had to do this independently, free of the government, because they would often be suing the government. That's a moment when the mainstream press was highly critical of this nascent new organization, but they struggled. And the powerful story is that they have survived for 100 years. I'm not sure we could point to other civic and private organizations in American history that have survived, prospered, and are as relevant today as they were in the beginning.
Let's talk about the biographies of some of the founders. You mentioned several women were important in the founding of the ACLU. So was Roger Baldwin. But let's talk about the women first. Talk about Lillian Wald and Crystal Eastman, please.
Yeah, these were amazing women, and anyone who wants to study this era from a number of trajectories would do well. I am indebted. You mentioned it briefly at the outset. Ellis Coase has written Democracy, If We Can Keep It, the ACLU's 100-year fight for rights in America. It's extraordinary. It's a history of the United States told through the lens of the history of the ACLU. And he goes deep into the origins. when, as you mentioned, feminists like Crystal Eastman Benedict at the time, the suffragette and social work pioneer Jane Addams, and a politically connected woman named Gertrude Minturn Pinchot, formed the Women's Peace Party in 1915 to enlist all American women in arousing the nation to respect the sacredness of human life and to abolish war. Then Lillian Wald, who was a stalwart peace activist, a trained nurse, and others formed the American Union Against Militarism. And they recruited this young 33-year-old social worker and teacher of psychology, Roger Nash Baldwin, in 1917 to head that group. They issued pamphlets on the constitutional rights in wartime. They initially formed the National Civil Liberties Bureau. And when Congress passed the draconian Espionage Act of 1917, which tragically is being used to this very day against Edward Snowden and Julian Assange, it was in that period, after the second round of Palmer raids, the Attorney General Mitchell Palmer was rounding up protesters, anarchists, and others, and indicted the industrial workers of the world. So in January of 2020, those women and others and Roger Baldwin met in a small civic club in Lower Manhattan, and they formed the American Civil Liberties Union, and it began its work on January 20, 1920.
And what was the mission of the ACLU?
They saw it very clearly to enforce the panoply of rights that on paper were protected in the Constitution and primarily in the Bill of Rights, as well as in the Civil War Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. They saw what was happening around them, this suffocating patriotism, this invocation of a single orthodoxy of public opinion surrounding World War I at that point. President Woodrow Wilson had gone from being a peace candidate to a war president. Very few newspapers or no other single organization was standing up for constitutional rights. So the ACLU saw that need and they filled it.
The movement in those days was being spied upon just like it is now. And that was the beginning of J. Edgar Hoover, wasn't it?
Yes, it has come out later through Freedom of Information Act requests that since its founding, the federal government largely and some state and local governments had infiltrated the ACLU since 1920. They were keeping files on leading members such as Felix Frankfurter, who later went on to be a Supreme Court justice, Helen Keller, famous in her own right, who was an early supporter of the ACLU. A lot of people don't know that. And it was J. Edgar Hoover, this young bureaucrat, chosen to head this new federal agency, who eventually was accumulating hundreds of thousands of files. And they would, during the entire course of the ACLU's history, monitor the ACLU. Ellis Coase disappointedly points out that there were some people within the ACLU who cooperated with the FBI. They felt it was in the best interest of the organization and the country. And as a result, some of the history of the ACLU is found in these redacted reports and files inside the FBI that show that, in a sense, the FBI early on saw the potential of this organization. As they would say, they saw the threat of this organization, and they continued to monitor, surveil, and infiltrate it throughout its history.
Yeah, well, Hoover then was clipping magazine and newspaper articles about people in the movement. Now, of course, it's on steroids because they've got a surveillance setup of our computers and our cell phones, cameras on the corners. It's the same idea, but just technologically much more advanced. Steve Rohde, I wanted to ask you about the famous situation involving Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. In 1940, she was removed from the board of directors of the ACLU because she was in the Communist Party. The Communist Party supported at that time the Soviet Union's invasion of Finland and its non-aggression pact with Germany. And many ACLU members argued that her expulsion was contrary to the principles of the organization. Since then, the ACLU has apologized for its actions. What role did fear play in the expulsion of the rebel girl, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn?
This is such an important chapter. It's a dark chapter. It's a disappointing chapter in the ACLU's history. Alice Coase, in his book, does not sugarcoat it. Elizabeth Gurley Flynn was an extraordinary figure in left politics. She had been a founder of the ACLU in 1920. She had been, by 1940, 20 years on the board of directors of the ACLU. She was the only woman among the industrial workers of the world, the IWW Wobblies, who had been criminally charged and stood trial earlier in that period. So this was a towering figure, but a small faction initially of the ACLU board, as you say, motivated by fear, fearing for the reputation of the ACLU, the effectiveness of the ACLU, and the left, began a period of formally disassociating itself from members of the Communist Party. They passed motions in the board of directors, and in May of 1940, they called a special board meeting to expel Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. She was a rabble-rouser. She did not take it lying down. She asked a question that resonates to anyone in any political movement of how could the ACLU defend communists in the right to teach and to hold public office, which they were doing publicly and rightfully, if they themselves exclude me solely as a communist. It was a huge battle. It went public. She defended herself in the newspapers. But ignobly, the board voted in the dead of night a majority to sustain the charges that she was sympathetic to a totalitarian government, and they expelled her from the ACLU board. It was a dark and ugly chapter, but in a way, it's a teachable moment. It really asks, in our own time, during these periods of national turmoil, when the popular will is so inflamed by calls for blind patriotism and strict obedience to political orthodoxy of the moment, even people of good intentions may be tempted to buckle under and forego their principles. So although it's a dark chapter, one of only a few in the ACLU's 100-year history, it reminds us of the strength it takes in our own organizations, in our lives, around the dinner table with our family and children and our crazy uncle and people at the workplace, whatever your context, that when you see wrong, when you see serious violations of civil liberties going on by the dominant established culture and political system, can you find the strength to resist, or will you succumb to the immense pressure that society and organizations put on people? And I think that's a lesson each of us needs to internalize and take to heart.
Yeah, I agree. It's particularly true these days with what they call the cancel culture, and a lot of pressure being put on people to think for yourself. Steve Rohde, you've been on the board of the Southern California ACLU for over 25 years, And I wanted to ask you about the organization. Please describe its growth. Where does it exist in our country now? How many chapters, how many lawyers are connected with it? And what's been the situation with the ACLU since 3.5 years ago when Trump was elected?
I'm a card-carrying member of the ACLU. I'm proud of that. I don't pull any punches when I do my writing and speaking and organizing because I think it is one of the most important organizations in our country today. So from that small band of advocates in 1920, it continued to expand over the years. Its history in racial justice is little known and has been a heart of the organization throughout its history. It comes down to the present day. It had setbacks and criticism. There was a period in the 1970s when the American Nazi Party chose to plan a march down Main Street in Skokie, Illinois, the home of a lot of survivors of the Holocaust. And true to its principles, and this is a moment of honor for the ACLU, the ACLU chose and was asked and decided to represent them, the Nazis, in their right to peacefully, without weapons, which we may come to later, and without threats of violence, to peacefully march in Skokie. The ACLU took that case through the courts. They prevailed. Ironically, the Nazis, when they won that right, didn't march in Skokie. They went to downtown Chicago. The ACLU took a lot of criticism during that period, losing upwards of 30,000 members. But it was an important precedent because the case law was later cited in civil rights cases when civil rights workers were marching down Main Street in southern cities, where those cities were offended by civil rights workers. And it set up and enforced that principle that when it comes to the peaceful exercise of First Amendment rights, of free speech and assembly and press and the like, defending the right of people to exercise those rights is not the same as defending the content or the message, even a hateful and offensive message that the groups may be espousing. And it's been a bulwark to create an atmosphere where over the last several months we've seen the vibrancy of public demonstrations until, of course, the federal government has interceded, as we'll talk about. Fortunately, the ACLU grew and then the election of Donald Trump will always be a pivotal moment in the history of our country, as well as the history of the ACLU. Right after he was elected, the ACLU took ads, said, "We will see you in court." And by early 2019, the ACLU claimed 1.85 million card-carrying members, four times what it had only in 2016. Its annual budget reached a remarkable $400 million, and it had national staff of had grown to 550 people, affiliate staff to 1,180. The ACLU today has affiliates in every state of the union. It has three affiliates in California. By a sharing arrangement, funds that are collected are shared with smaller affiliates who cannot necessarily sustain themselves, especially in southern cities, so that everyone has an executive director and a lawyer available to them. And the ACLU has so stepped up, and think about this, they have filed over 371 legal actions and lawsuits against the Trump administration, 50 in the handling of the COVID-19 pandemic and the George Floyd protests. And they're not only active in court, which is what a lot of people think of the ACLU for, but they have community organizing wings in every affiliate. And upon the election of Trump, the ACLU formed People Power, which is a grassroots organizing effort. By recent count, they had held over 12,000 events, a million phone calls, and almost 7 million texts advocating the entire gamut of the threat to civil liberties. So the ACLU today is up to the task. Virtually every week in an affiliate somewhere, new legal actions and community organizing is taking place.
Well, like you, Steve Rohde, I'm a proud member of the ACLU and have been for many years. I wanted to tell you a joke, and maybe you've heard it, but this joke is going around. And the joke is this: what's the worst day of the Trump administration? And the answer is tomorrow. Well, tomorrow has come to the citizens of Portland, Oregon. The Trump administration is stationed for a number of different armed federal police forces in that city against the wishes of the mayor and the governor. And these people are dressed in camouflage uniforms with no name tags. They're going around driving unmarked cars and vans. They're picking up protesters, interrogating them, driving them around, and then dropping them off. And the ACLU in Oregon is suing the Trump administration for its policing in Portland. What's the Trump administration doing in Portland? Why do people say that this is fascism in action? And are you afraid that Portland is only the first place and that it'll spread to other cities?
Well, I'm not only afraid of that, the president has promised it. He is using Portland as a test case. Of course, he already used it in Washington, D.C. to prepare for his photo op holding a Bible in front of the church, and had a sweep of federal officers to remove peaceful protesters. So this is of a piece. Portland is the latest use of this tactic. This is a fascist tactic. There's no question about it. You can look through some of the history I've recounted of the United States, and you can look at contemporary examples around the world where dictatorships, fascist regimes, authoritarian regimes, will use police forces, in this case federally authorized, totally under the control, in our case, of Donald Trump, and over and in against the wishes of the mayor of Portland and the governor of Oregon, against their wishes, to sweep into these cities, showing physical militaristic force of tear gas and rubber bullets. Anyone can go online to see the young man brutally hit in the face with rubber bullets and others who've been seriously injured. Trump has said that he's prepared to go into New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, Detroit, Baltimore, Oakland, which, of course, he selects as Democratic cities, polarizing and making this a partisan issue. This is very serious. I'm proud of the ACLU for filing its lawsuits. Actually, the initial lawsuits in Portland by the ACLU were filed weeks ago to deal with how journalists and peacekeepers were being blocked from these rallies because the journalists are the eyes and ears for the rest of us to know what's going on. So it's of a piece for a fascist government to both use military force and to block the free press from covering what is going on. Fortunately, there have been courageous journalists, and by now mainstream media is covering this situation. I think anyone listening to our voices today should support the ACLU of Oregon, which is on the front lines. The governments of the city and the state are separately suing the federal government to restrain them from doing this. This is going to be a test case of whether a civil society can restrain lawless federal troops from militarizing, inflaming, and wreaking havoc in our cities. And the obvious political purpose cannot be ignored. With Trump on the ropes in terms of his reelection, pushing a law and order platform, inflaming his base and thinking he can expand his base by breeding fear, he is using these forces. And we need public opinion to rise up against him. We need folks to write to their elected officials, whether they live in Oregon or elsewhere, to speak out to their senators and representatives, to write letters to the editor, to chime in on petitions that are circulating online. We've all got to do our part. We may be cloistered and quarantined, but that doesn't restrain us from exercising our constitutional rights in such a dangerous moment.
Where do you see the ACLU a year from now, 5 years from now, 100 years from now?
Well, if you'll book me 100 years from now, you and I can do a radio show on that. Less facetiously, this is a vibrant, strong organization. It has dug deep roots in communities around the country. People are recognizing the ACLU for what it does. Now, political winds may change, there's no reason to shy away from my desire and your desire to see Donald Trump evicted from the White House next January. But I want to end by saying that it has been through Democratic administrations and Republican administrations that the ACLU has had to stand up. The ACLU has taken action most previously against the Obama administration when it lost its way. The ACLU will do that every time in states and localities, regardless of the partisan makeup of legislatures or governments. The ACLU is built for that. They may find a drop off in people thinking all the world's problems are solved by removing Trump from office. Trump has simply lifted the garbage can off of centuries of racism, of bigotry, of hatred in this country. That has existed. The fight and the reckoning we're in right now will go on. And I believe the ACLU is going to play a pivotal role in that for the next 100 years.
Stephen Rohde, that's spelled O-R-O-H-D-E. How can people learn more about your work and the work of the ACLU?
Yes, ACLU affiliates have good online service in every state. A simple Googling of the ACLU, most recently for Oregon, you can find everything that's going on. I'm available through the ACLU of Southern California, where I'm a board member. I do a lot of writing on the Los Angeles Review of Books, the LA Daily Journal, the Los Angeles Lawyer Magazine, to push out as much of this message as I can. And through your show, anyone can also reach me.
My sincere thank you for your work over the last more than a quarter of a century with the ACLU, your marvelous writing, and for your appearing on Law and Disorder. Thank you so much, Steve. You be well. Take it easy.
Thank you, Michael. It's my pleasure, and you are a form of resistance by doing this show. And for the decades that you and your colleagues have done it, I'm proud of you, and it's a privilege to be with you.
Thank you, Steve. You be well.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. July has been a legal roller coaster ride with respect to efforts to shut down the Dakota Access and Keystone XL pipelines. First, a judge invalidated federal permits, saying that the Army Corps of Engineers failed to address the potential damage from oil spills in the Dakota pipeline. He ordered the company, Energy Transfer, to stop pumping crude oil through South Dakota. And on the heels of that order, a federal appellate court temporarily blocked that shutdown. As for KXL, which would carry tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada through Montana and South Dakota before reaching Nebraska, the Supreme Court in early July rejected the Trump administration's request to allow construction of the KXL pipeline by TC Energy.
A Montana court ruling halting construction therefore still stands. As listeners will recall, protesters and lawsuits against both pipelines cite the devastation that pipeline leaks would cause to the environment. In the case of tar sands oil, it's thicker, highly volatile, and more corrosive than conventional crude oil. This increases the likelihood of leaks, and that renders it far more difficult, if not impossible, to clean up after any spills. Joining us today is attorney Natalie Segovia. Natalie is a staff attorney for the Water Protector Legal Collective, the organization that grew out of the legal tent at the Ocheti-Sakowin camp in the Standing Rock resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline. Natalie chairs the Indigenous Peoples' Rights Committee of the National Lawyers Guild and serves on the board of directors of the Alliance for Global Justice. She also serves on the Indian Law Section Executive Council of the Arizona State Bar. Welcome, Natalie, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Please tell our listeners how you came to be involved with the pipeline protests through both the National Lawyers Guild and the Water Protector Legal Collective.
So the National Lawyers Guild has as its mission the protection of human rights and rights of ecosystems over property rights. I've been a member of the National Lawyers Guild since my time in law school and have really been inspired by the efforts of the Guild for a long, long time. The Water Protector Legal Collective actually grew out of the legal efforts on the ground at Ocheti-Sakowin in Standing Rock back in 2016. So the WPLC is essentially the Indigenous-led legal collective that is focused on legal support advocacy and knowledge sharing for water protectors in the fight for the earth, the environment, and climate justice movements. So I am the staff attorney for the Water Protector Legal Collective, and I'm also chair of the National Lawyers Guild Indigenous Peoples' Rights Committee.
Were you ever on site at any of the protests?
No, unfortunately not. In 2016, I had just returned from out of the country, and I was based out of Arizona. I'm still based out of Arizona currently. However, was involved in most of the and some of the legal research from the NLG side, from the National Lawyers Guild side. So the Lawyers Guild, like it has really been involved with being on the ground as part of its Mass Defense Committee work and the Indigenous Peoples' Rights Committees. There were folks that were on the ground from day one at Ocheti-Sakowin and really contributed to working with grassroots organizations and with the tribal members that were leading the resistance, because it's important to highlight that this has been an Indigenous-led resistance from day one.
Let's start by talking about the Supreme Court's recent ruling with respect to the Keystone XL pipeline. And if you could first just give a brief overview of the kind of damage that a tar sands leak could cause. Do you think that information was a persuasive factor in the Supreme Court's decision?
Absolutely. You know, I think tar sands is, as some have said, not your grandfather's crude. Right. And they are highly volatile, much thicker, more corrosive. They provide a greater risk to the environment than conventional lighter crude oil. Essentially, with tar sands, it's not just a matter of the extraction, but also the environmental impact that tar sands oil could have within the actual pipelines. Because it's heavier, because it's thicker, and if you Google tar sands oil, you'll see just how thick these are. This oil is, it looks almost like just mud, right? Having all of this flowing under a pipeline, being pushed forward under a pipeline that runs through the breadbasket of America, right? It would cross over the Ogallala Aquifer, which supplies water to Nebraska and surrounding states. The KXL pipeline would really cross several different states on its way to the Gulf Coast of Mexico, over 1,179 miles from Montana to South Dakota before reaching Nebraska. And it would cross under 20 miles of waterways, many of which freeze under cold temperatures, which cause pipelines to burst when the temperatures go down. Again, it's not really a matter of whether a pipeline will leak, but when and where. Specifically regarding extraction, too, the tar sands that originate in Canada really are having an impact on Canada's forests. It's depleting water, freshwater resources, threatens the health and livelihood of Indigenous peoples, creates massive amounts of toxic waste, and it creates about 3 to 4 times the carbon pollution of conventional crude oil extraction processing. So I do think that those are definitely things that the Supreme Court took into account, although one problem was that in the underlying permitting process, there was supposed to be an environmental impact statement conducted, which was never actually fully realized.
Natalie, talk briefly, if you will, about TC Energy. What is their track record?
So TransCanada, which is now known as TC Energy, has a poor track record. If you go onto their website, they'll say that they have an amazing 65-year track record of safe energy transportation. But it's not a question of whether pipelines will leak, just where and how much. So the Keystone Pipeline, which is the sister pipeline of the Keystone XL pipeline, had 14 spills alone in its first year of operation. According to the National Energy Board, there's 17 of 39 major pipeline accidents in Canada from 1992 to 2014 occurred on pipelines owned by TransCanada or its subsidiary. So again, this is the same corporation, TC Energy, just with TransCanada under a new name, TC Energy. Sure, some of that might have to do with the corrosiveness of tar sands, but it really shows a need for a study of pipeline regulations for tar sands pipelines. There's not many of them. You know, this is something that TransCanada in particular has moved forward. And it's a company with immense financial power, immense political influence, and it's a company that knows how to systematically use litigation to clear routes for pipelines, influence policymakers both in Canada and the U.S., to remove environmental and other regulations that can stand in its way to make a profit.
I always think of Canada as being so much more progressive than the United States, but...
I think we all do, but unfortunately, it's not the case when it comes to extractive industry or Indigenous people.
Let me ask you this about leaks. We're all familiar with images on the news of oil spills into vast waterways, but what is it like when there's a leak underground? Is it immediately discernible?
So it's not. And I think that that's actually a good point, right? Tar sands oil, even underwater, the type of oil will sink immediately. So it's unlike traditional crude, which might be easier to clean up. There's actually no scientifically proven way to clean up a tar sands oil spill. So there's definitely still scientific barriers to even being able to effectively clean up oil spills. We saw this in the Chevron Ecuador oil spill case, you know, many years ago. It was still under litigation. I think it was over 20 years of litigation. But essentially, the contamination of Chevron in the Amazon, in the Ecuadorian Amazon, has caused cancer. It's been impact the health and welfare of displaced Indigenous communities. And there's still oil wells in the Ecuadorian Amazon that are just underneath the substrate of the land. So it impacts the water sources. With Keystone XL, you have that possibility in very real form, because it would cross over 20 miles of waterways, which is really kind of incredible when you think about it, because we already have water access issues in the United States. Right, we can talk about Flint, Michigan. We can talk about access to water here in the Southwest. I mean, I live in Arizona, so obviously it's a constant question of whether we will eventually run out of water when the Colorado River dries up.
I understand that a new lawsuit was just filed on July 14th. Who filed it, and what are their claims?
So after the ruling on July 6th by the Supreme Court that basically stopped the Keystone XL construction, there was a new lawsuit that was filed on July 14th by the NRDC, Bold Alliance, Center for Biological Diversity, Friends of the Earth, and the Sierra Club. And it was not filed against TC Energy specifically. Rather, it was filed against the U.S. Department of the Interior, the Bureau of Land Management, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in the District Court of Montana. These are these federal bodies that are in charge of the protection of our wildlife, of our environment, but also both the Department of the Interior and the Bureau of Land Management work closely with Native American tribes to really regulate and make sure that the government is acting as a trustee for Indian lands. So the suit challenges the BLM's approval or the Bureau of Land Management's approval to construct the KXL pipeline on 44 miles of federally controlled public lands in Montana. Again, they cite flawed environmental reviews by the Bureau of Land Management and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Those flaws really stem from the fast-tracking of the pipeline that came on the heels of the Trump administration's rise to power in 2017. So I guess one thing, if we go back to the very inception of the Keystone XL pipeline, and since it was first proposed in 2008, tribes and environmental activists on both sides of the Medicine Line or the U.S.-Canada border have been concerned about those risks, the risks that the KXL poses not just to Indigenous peoples, but also to non-Native people, wildlife, endangered wildlife, land, water, earth, the immense irreparable harm that this pipeline could cause, including, in particular, right, access to water and the threat that it could potentially cause to water and wildlife habitats. Obama, in 2015, vetoed the pipeline, and under executive order in 2017, the Trump administration fast-tracked that. So the State Department issued at that time permits that overlooked tribal treaties and approvals of easements and such that were not done with prior consultation with the tribes, and overlooked the importance of doing a thorough environmental impact study.
Okay, now speaking of environmental impact studies, let's shift gears for a minute to talk about the Dakota Pipeline, because July's also been a newsworthy month for that. The members of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe have claimed persuasively that the Army Corps of Engineers improperly issued construction permits and failed to conduct adequate environmental analysis of that pipeline's impact. Procedurally, what's happening with that pipeline?
So essentially, again, also on July 6th, there was another victory for the Dakota Access Pipeline, where a federal judge ordered Energy Transfer Partners, which is the company in that pipeline and the owners and operators of the Dakota Access Pipeline, to stop the flow of oil through the pipeline and empty it of oil within the next 30 days, so by August 5th. At that time, you know, the court ordered the government to conduct a full-fledged environmental impact statement examining the risk of the pipeline to the Standing Rock, Cheyenne River, Oglala, and Yankton Sioux tribes and the environment. They really recognized the potential effect, disastrous effect of an oil spill under Lake Oahe and the poor track record in detecting and stopping leaks. As he had mentioned earlier, sometimes, you know, pipeline leaks go undetected and sometimes they go unreported, especially if they are contained on site. So those don't have to be reported. So the number of pipeline leaks that we actually have statistics on is actually much lower than the actual number of leaks. Essentially, on July 14th, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit issued an administrative stay. An administrative stay of the order that stopped the flow of oil through the Dakota Access Pipeline, essentially giving the court enough time to consider the stay and allowing the Energy Transfer Partners and the tribes to file briefs. The court did indicate, however, that the administrative order shouldn't be construed in any way as a ruling on the merits. So what the court may actually rule is still to be seen.
The question of an environmental impact study, doesn't it take at least a year to do an effective one?
Yes, and in fact, these have been issues that have been raised from the very beginning. So the full environmental impact statement, the district court in its orders regarding the Dakota Access Pipeline really stated that the water crossing permit program that allowed for Dakota Access Pipeline to be built, which was the NWP 12 permit, and allowed the Dakota Access Pipeline to cross under the Missouri River and Lake Oahe, which is a reservoir created by a dam on the Missouri River and are both federally regulated waterways in North Dakota. These were in violation of the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, and the Clean Water Act. So these are things that have been raised from the inception. However, the thing with the courts is that we never have a sense of, or there's very little certainty in terms of what can actually come of a legal decision. And so in this case, hopefully it will lead to an environmental impact statement that will take into account the full scope of the environmental impact that this could have. However, the court did say in its March and June orders and its July order that the standard remedy for a violation of NEPA is vacating the viability of a project, which is why this was essentially, the Dakota Access Pipeline was essentially halted.
Natalie, have you learned a lot about environmental impact through your work over the last few years on these issues?
Yes, and unfortunately, it's a constant battle to continue learning. I think that's one of the unique aspects of the law. But I think that the importance of the law and importance of environmental regulations and the importance of treaties are becoming more and more a part of our collective consciousness politically, even for non-lawyers, and especially for Indigenous-centered and Indigenous-led resistance, right? I see on a daily basis tribal members that are incredibly knowledgeable of what the impact of federal laws and regulations could have on their people, on the environment, on the land, on the water. So these are definitely things that, while might seem out of the reach of people to understand without having expertise in the law, it's definitely something that I think is important for the general population, for all of us as citizens, to really understand the impacts of.
For listeners who may not have been following these two cases, how would you frame their overall significance in terms of the power of the people who have been protesting these, often at great peril to their own safety over the last 4 years, and in terms of what we're seeing with uprisings in the streets of the nation for racial equality? How do you think history will look back on these pipeline cases?
You know, I think that one thing that was very clear in 2016 with the No DAPL, or at the Standing Rock protests, it marked a really important moment in recent history of Indigenous-led resistance. It was a moment of unity, not just for Lakota tribes and Dakota tribes, but also of Indigenous peoples that flooded to Standing Rock with a sense of urgency and an acknowledgement that corporate accountability is something that we are fighting against worldwide. The reality that pipelines leak, that's something that we as Indigenous peoples have come to understand and we have to fight against. So it's not just a struggle against a specific corporation, but against extractive industry as a whole. And I think that's a struggle for the future. I think it's a struggle for what kind of world we want to live in. I think we're seeing that even now in terms of the movements in the streets, as you were mentioning, right? We have a struggle between two visions of this nation at this time, a vision of the world that we currently live in and a vision for a world that we want to live in. There are definitely still many obstacles, both legal and non-legal, that communities continue to face. So, for instance, even though the Keystone XL pipeline has been halted by the Supreme Court, there's still other forms of construction that remain. So we have man camp construction that have long been tied to sexual violence, disproportionately impacting Indigenous women and girls, that could exacerbate a crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. There's a great movie called Wind River that highlights some of those issues around man camps and the general impunity for crimes arising out of that type of circumstance. And even though we have laws that are meant to protect, federal laws that are meant to protect tribal sovereignty in tribal nations and women, like the Tribal Law and Order Act and Violence Against Women Act, sometimes these federal laws actually lack teeth. And we can see the disproportionate impact of its application within tribal communities. I do think that we have a long road ahead, but those struggles continue. Even just recently, there was an eviction notice published by members of the Ocheti Sakowin, or legally known as the Sioux Tribe, for KXL and DAPL to be evicted from Lakota lands. And I think it's a powerful statement to how Indigenous people have understood the law and how it's being framed. So it acknowledges that under the U.S. Constitution, treaties are the supreme law of the land. And there was a Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868, which acknowledged the sovereignty of the Ocheti Sakowin over their land, as long as the grass shall grow and the rivers will flow. And the treaty states, if bad men among whites or among other people subjected to the authority of the United States shall commit any wrong upon the person or property of the Indians, the United States will, upon proof made to the agent and forwarded to the Commissioner of Indian Affairs at Washington City, proceed at once to cause the offender to be arrested and punished according to the laws of the United States, and also reimburse the injured person for the loss sustained. So essentially what the eviction notice argues thereafter is that they acknowledge the corporate personhood of the entities and owners of Dakota Access Pipeline and the Keystone XL Pipeline insofar as they are bad men mentioned in the Fort Laramie Treaty. They attacked our people with dogs at Standing Rock, destroyed the graves of Indigenous ancestors, threaten our source of drinking water with deadly contamination, and use our water to build these pipelines. They bring their man camps that come with drugs and terrible violence and build their pipelines across our lands without our consent. So I think this is an invocation that's very powerful. When I read it just yesterday, it was really powerful for me to read it, but I think that we'll see and we'll continue to see the active resistance of Indigenous peoples and grassroots organizations that are acting as an important counterweight to the government in general and corporations that don't want to be held accountable.
Yes, and those are two mighty forces that collaborate so insidiously. Natalie, unfortunately, we're out of time. How can our listeners learn more about these issues and stay on top of what's happening legally with the pipelines?
We typically issue newsletters from the Water Protector Legal Collective, so you can sign up for our newsletter and we'll provide some legal updates. You can follow Indigenous-led organizations and media on Facebook and social media. Some good ones are Indigenous Environmental Network, Indigenous Rising Media, and Indian Country Today. And I guess the question you didn't ask me is, what can people do? And I think that's important too. And I think donating, you know, as much as we don't like to talk about money, we have to talk about money. And we're battling corporations that have endless amounts of it. So definitely donate. Donate to local organizations. Donate to organizations like the National Lawyers Guild and the Water Protector Legal Collective that are doing this type of work. And also divest, right? Follow the money. There's a great project run by Michelle Cook, who's also a Water Protector Legal Collective board member, and it's Divest, Invest, Protect, which really follows the money and tries to look at divestment efforts so that you know where your local banks have invested your money, which is often pipelines.
Yes, so important. Thank you for mentioning that. Natalie, we are really proud of the work you're doing. You're an inspiration, and we hope to be able to stay in touch with you over the next few months.
Thanks so much, Heidi. I really appreciate it, and thank you for having me today.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.